Montaigne, that men are not to judge of our happiness till after death, 1580. Epaminondas asked which of the three should be held in highest esteem, Cabrius, Iphicrates, or himself, replied, "You must first see us die before deciding." The characters in the anecdote were Greek generals who fought for Athens or Thebes against Sparta in the 4th century BC. 8. Death as a universal and equalizer. The Stoic finds consolation for death in the reflection that it is a fate common to everyone. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 1:4. We therefore will find the greatest comfort in the thought that what has befallen us was suffered by all who came before, and will be suffered by all to come. And nature has, it seems to me, made universal that which she made hardest to bear, so that the equality of our fate might console us for its cruelty. Seneca, Epistles, 77:13. What multitudes doomed to death will follow you? What multitudes will accompany you? You would feel more brave, I suppose, if many thousands were to die with you. And yet there are many thousands, both humans and animals, who at this very moment, while you are irresolute about death, are breathing their last in their various ways. Death equalizes all people, which might encourage magnanimity in life. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 6:24. When Alexander of Macedon and his mule driver died, they came to the same thing. For either they were absorbed back into the same principles that produced them, or they were scattered alike among the atoms. Seneca on Anger, 3:43:1. Why are you angry with your slave, with your master, with your patron, with your client? Wait a little. Behold, death comes, which will make you equals. Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 11:2. Toward death, at different paces, moves the entire crowd that now squabbles in the forum, that looks on at the theaters, that prays in the temples, both those you love and revere and those you despise. One heap of ashes will make equal. Seneca, Epistles, 91:16. We are born unequal. We die equal. I say the same thing about cities as about their inhabitants. Ardea was captured, so was Rome. The founder of human law has not distinguished us based on lineage or illustrious ancestry, except while we are alive. Ardea is an ancient town south of Rome that was once sacked by the Samnites, a group of tribes from southern Italy. By Seneca's time, it was lightly populated and best known for its malarial climate and the imperial elephants kept nearby. 9. The proximity of death. Once the fear of it is subdued, death is regarded by the Stoics as a resource, a remedy for pride, and a teacher of wisdom. They therefore pursue a kind of closeness with death, rather than distance from it. Stoics observe that the possibility of death is nearer than we usually imagine, a point offered not to cause anxiety, but to dispel it. Rather than a frightening thing that advances on us, death is next to us all the time. It is best accepted as a reason to live well in the time that remains. Seneca on Providence, 6:8-9. The fatted bodies of bulls fall from a tiny wound, and creatures of great strength are felled by a single stroke of the human hand. No deep retreat conceals the soul. You need no knife at all to root it out, no deeply driven wound to find the vital parts. Death lies near at hand. Seneca, Epistles, 4:8-9. Reflect that a bandit or an enemy can put a knife to your throat, and though he is not your master, every slave has the power of life and death over you. Therefore I declare to you, whoever scorns his own life is master of yours. Seneca, Epistles, 49:11. You are mistaken if you think that only on an ocean voyage is there a very slight space between life and death. No, the distance between is just as narrow everywhere. It is not everywhere that death shows himself so near at hand, yet everywhere he is as near at hand. Montaigne, that to study philosophy is to learn to die, 1580. In truth, dangers and risks do little or nothing to bring us closer to death. If we think of the millions of threats that hang over us, apart from whichever one now seems to threaten us most, we will realize that death is equally nearby, whether we are healthy or feverish, at sea or at home, in battle or at rest. Melville was a reader of Seneca and Montaigne. Melville, Moby Dick, 1851. All men live enveloped in whale lines. All are born with halters round their necks. But it is only when caught in the swift, sudden turn of death that mortals realize the silent, subtle, ever-present perils of life. And if you be a philosopher, though seated in the whaleboat, you would not at heart feel one whit more of terror than though seated before your evening fire with a poker, and not a harpoon by your side. Seneca had a related idea to offer. Causes for fear are everywhere. Oddly enough, this can relieve us from fear about any one of them, or all of them. Anything might kill you any time, so you might as well forge on without worrying about it. Seneca, Natural Questions 6-2-1. I say that there is no lasting peace for anything that can perish and cause to perish, but I place this fact in the category of solace, actually a very powerful solace, since fear without remedy is what foolish men have. If you wish to fear nothing, consider that everything is to be feared. 10. Intimacy with death. The nearness of death as a physical matter is matched by the Stoics' efforts to keep it nearby in the mind. Stoics recommend thinking about death often, as they find that it helps toward virtue without a need for argument. Seneca, Epistles 1:14-27. Nothing will give you so much help toward moderation as the frequent thought that life is short and that the little we have is uncertain. Whatever you are doing, be mindful of death. Epictetus, Enchiridion 21. Let death and exile and every other thing that appears dreadful be every day before your eyes, but most of all death, and you will never harbor any low thoughts, nor have an extravagant desire for anything. Seneca, Epistles 4:4-5. No one can have a peaceful life who thinks too much about lengthening it, or who believes that living through many consulships is a great blessing. Rehearse this thought every day, so that you may be able to peacefully give up this life to which so many clutch and cling, just as those snatched away by a rushing stream clutch and cling to briars and sharp rocks. Montaigne, that to study philosophy is to learn to die, 1580. Let us strip death of its strangeness. Let us spend time with it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing on our minds more often. At every moment, let us imagine death in all of its aspects. When a horse stumbles, when a tile falls, when a pin pricks us even slightly, let us immediately turn over this thought. What if that had been death itself? Johnson, The Rambler, number 17, 1750. The disturbers of our happiness in this world are our desires, our griefs, and our fears, and to all these the frequent consideration of death is a certain and adequate remedy. Epicurus was succinct on the subject. Epicurus and Seneca, Epistles 26:8. Think on death. 11. Mortality as inspiration. Reflection on death, as we have seen, is viewed by the Stoic as a way to reduce the fear of it, but also as a cause for urgency in living and a source of inspiration. Some further comments on the latter theme from Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:69. The perfection of moral character consists in this: to spend each day as if it were the last, to be neither agitated nor numb, and not to pretend. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:56. Think of yourself as having died, and as having finished the life you have lived until now. The portion that is allowed to you beyond this, live out according to nature. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:37. You are going to die at any minute, and yet you still are not simple and straightforward, nor do you have peace of mind, nor are you free from suspicion that you will be hurt by external things. Nor are you kind to everyone, nor do you see that being wise consists solely in being just. From Seneca, Epistles 23:10, we must make it our aim to have already lived long enough. Seneca, Epistles 101:7-8, let us order our minds as if we had come to the end. Let us postpone nothing, Let us balance life's account every day. Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 10:4. Take as much as fortune gives, remembering that it comes with no guarantee. Snatch the pleasures your children bring. Let your children in turn find delight in you, and drain joy to the dregs without delay. Nothing is promised for this night. Nay, I have granted too long an extension, not even for this hour. We must hurry. The enemy is right behind us. Chapter 5. Desire. We saw in Chapter 1 the foundational Stoic claim that we react not to things, but to our judgments about them. It doesn't necessarily follow, though, that those judgments are wrong. Indeed, one might react to the Stoic proposition by offering to concede it without effect. If we desire or dread something, and the desire or dread arises from our thoughts about it, maybe the thoughts are right. How are we to know? Chapter 2 provided a general answer to that question. Attachment to externals is a trap, and we have seen the start of specific answers in chapters 3 and 4, which showed how the Stoics think we misjudge time, space, and death. But this chapter begins a series of closer inquiries into some more particular judgments we make about the world. The Stoics' notion that everything is opinion becomes for them a warrant to examine our usual thinking more closely, department by department, to see whether it squares with reason and with what we know of human nature. To simplify only a bit, Stoicism views most of our miseries as driven by the ways we relate to desires and fears about the future, and to pleasures and pains in the present. This chapter begins by considering desire, how it works, and how we might handle it more rationally. We have noted that the Stoic teachers each have certain specialties. For Epictetus, externals. For Marcus Aurelius, perspective. On the subject of psychology, which comes to the fore in this chapter, the great Stoic specialist is Seneca the Younger. Seneca, along with others we will see, gave early recognition to many tendencies of the mind that are relearned, often the hard way, by every generation and most individuals, that we most desire what we do not or cannot have, that the pursuit of a thing is more pleasing than the possession of it, that the possession of a good and familiarity with it tend to produce indifference or disgust, that we mismeasure the value of what we have or don't have by comparing it to our expectations or to the holdings of others. In sum, we talk to ourselves about our desires in ways that are constantly misleading. The Stoics seek to give us more accurate things to say, as well as some advice about how to avoid or outwit our irrationalities. 1. The insatiability of desires. The Stoics' first observation about desire is that getting what we want tends not to produce the satisfaction that we imagined. It makes us want more. New desires appear when other ones are spent. Our minds seem to have an appetite for desire itself, and for the illusion that fulfilling it will bring us to an endpoint. The end never arrives. Seneca, Epistles, 118:6. Who was ever satisfied after attainment with that which loomed up large as he prayed for it? Seneca, Epistles, 19:6. Why wait until there is nothing left for you to crave? That time will never come. We say that there is a succession of causes from which fate is put together. There is likewise a succession of desires. One is born from the end of another. Epictetus, Discourses, 4:1-174. You will learn the truth by experience. The things that people value highly and try hardest to get do them no good once they have them. Those who don't have them imagine that once they do, everything good will be theirs. Then they do get them, and the heat of their desires is the same. Their agitation is the same. Their disgust with what they possess is the same, and their wish for what they don't have is the same. Disordered physical appetites are a frequent source of analogy to explain desires of other kinds. Seneca, Epistles 15:11. At last, then, away with all these treacherous goods. Better when hoped for than when attained. If there were anything of substance in them, they eventually would bring satisfaction. As it is, they are a drink that makes you more thirsty. Epictetus Discourses 4:9, 4-5. Don't you know how thirst works in someone with a fever? It is nothing like the thirst of a man in good health. He drinks and is no longer thirsty. The sick man is happy only for a moment, then is nauseous. He converts the drink into bile. He vomits. His stomach hurts, and then he is thirstier still. It is just like this to crave riches and have riches, to crave power and have power, to crave a beautiful woman and sleep with her. Plutarch on Virtue and Vice 4:101c. Pile up gold, heap up silver, build covered walks, fill your house with slaves and the town with debtors. Unless you lay to rest the passions of the soul and put a curb on your insatiable desires and rid yourself of fear and anxiety, you are but pouring out wine for a man in a fever and giving honey to a man who is bilious and laying out a sumptuous banquet for people who are suffering from dysentery and can neither retain their food nor get any benefit from it, but are made even worse by it. This general theme of the Stoics, the illusion that fulfillment of a desire will bring us to a certain longed-for state of mind, which never quite arrives, has been taken up by many of their cousins and descendants. Plutarch, on Love of Wealth 3:524, c-d. He who has more than enough and yet hungers for still more will find no remedy in gold or silver or horses and sheep and cattle, but in casting out the source of mischief and being purged. For his ailment is not poverty, but insatiability and avarice, arising from the presence in him of a false and unreflecting judgment. And unless someone removes this, like a tapeworm, from his mind, he will never cease to need superfluities, that is, to want what he does not need. Montaigne, of A Saying of Caesar, 1580. Whatever falls into our possession, and knowledge fails to bring satisfaction, we go panting after things unknown and things to come, because the things that are present are never enough. It is not, in my view, that they lack what it takes to satisfy us, but rather that we hold them in an unhealthy and immoderate grip. A New Way to Think About the Pyramids. Johnson, Rasselas, 1759. I consider a pyramid as a monument to the insufficiency of human enjoyments. A king whose power is unlimited and whose treasures surmount all real and imaginary wants is compelled to solace by the erection of a pyramid. The satiety of dominion and tastelessness of pleasures, and to amuse the tediousness of declining life by seeing thousands laboring without end, and one stone for no purpose laid upon another. Whoever thou art that, not content with a moderate condition, imaginest happiness in royal magnificence, and dreamst that command or riches can feed the appetite of novelty with perpetual gratifications, survey the pyramids, and confess thy folly. Schopenhauer offered some interesting ways to explain the Stoic observation. Schopenhauer, The Wisdom of Life, 1851. When a piece of good fortune befalls us, our claims mount higher and higher, as there is nothing to regulate them. It is in this feeling of expansion that the delight of it lies, but it lasts no longer than the process itself, and when the expansion is complete, the delight ceases. We have become accustomed to the increase in our claims, and consequently indifferent to the amount of wealth which satisfies them. Schopenhauer, The Wisdom of Life, 1851. There is no absolute or definite amount of wealth which will satisfy a man. The amount is always relative, that is to say, just so much as will maintain the proportion between what he wants and what he gets. For to measure a man's happiness only by what he gets, and not also by what he expects to get, is as futile as to try and express a fraction which shall have a numerator but no denominator. A man never feels the loss of things which it never occurs to him to ask for. He is just as happy without them, whilst another, who may have 100 times as much, feels miserable because he has not got the one thing he wants. 2. Natural versus unnatural appetites. The Stoics sometimes explain bottomless desires by reference to their unnatural character. We have two kinds of appetites. Some are implanted by nature, such as hunger. These are finite and can be fully satisfied. Of course, they can recur. The satisfaction isn't permanent, but the measure of them is clear. We eat until we aren't hungry, and the same thing that was satisfying yesterday can be satisfying today. Other desires, such as the wish for status, are produced by social life, or are created by stimulating the appetite for things we don't need. Desires of this artificial kind are never quite satisfied. Their fulfillment isn't as pleasing as we imagined, and newer and bigger objects of them must always be sought. And because they aren't linked to a particular need, they have no natural stopping place. Seneca, Consolation to Helvia, 11:4. Every want that springs, not from any need, but from vice, is of a like character. However much you pile up for it will serve not to end, but to advance desire. He who keeps himself within natural limits will not feel poverty. He who exceeds them will be pursued by poverty even amid the greatest wealth. Seneca, Epistles 39:5-6. The measure of what is necessary is what is useful. But what standard can limit the superfluous? It is for this reason that men sink themselves in pleasures, and then cannot do without them when once they have become accustomed to them. And it is for this reason they are most wretched, that they have reached such a pass that what was once superfluous to them has become indispensable. Seneca, Epistles 16:8-9. Let the possessions of many wealthy men be piled up together for you. Assume fortune takes you far beyond a mere private income. It covers you in gold, dresses you in purple, brings you to that stage of luxury and riches at which you hide the ground under marble floors, so that you're able not only to have wealth, but to walk on it. Add statues and paintings and whatever art has devised in the service of luxury. What you will learn from these things is to long for more. Natural desires are finite. Those born of false opinion have no place to stop. There is no terminus to what is false. When you are traveling on a road, there must be an end, but wanderings have no limit. Some good later reworkings. Montaigne, Of Managing the Will, 1580. The laws of nature teach us what we legitimately need. The sages tell us that no one is poor according to nature. Everyone is poor according to opinion. They then distinguish skillfully between desires that come from nature and desires arising from our disordered imaginations. The desires that have limits come from nature. The ones that run away from us and never have an end are our own. Poverty in material things is easy to cure. Poverty of the soul, impossible. Johnson, The Idler, number 30, 1758. The desires of man increase with his acquisitions. Every step which he advances brings something within his view, which he did not see before, and which, as soon as he sees it, he begins to want. Where necessity ends, curiosity begins. And no sooner are we supplied with everything that nature can demand than we sit down to contrive artificial appetites. This theme is pursued further in Chapter 6, Section 8. 3. Chasing versus Having. Another deception identified by the Stoics: when we work toward a goal, we imagine the happiness that its attainment will bring, but the pursuit itself turns out to be more enjoyable than the capture of the thing pursued. Seneca, Epistles 9:7. The philosopher Attalus used to say, "It is more pleasant to make a friend than to have one, as it is more pleasant to the artist to paint than to have painted." When one is busy and absorbed in one's work, The very absorption affords great delight. But when one has withdrawn one's hand from the completed masterpiece, the pleasure is not so keen. Now it is the fruit of his art that he enjoys. It was the art itself that he enjoyed while he was painting. Attalus was a Stoic philosopher and one of Seneca's early teachers. Seneca described himself as having practically laid siege to his classroom, the first to arrive and the last to leave. Epistles 108:3. Seneca's father described Attalus as the subtlest and most articulate philosopher of his times. Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice, 2:6. Gratiano, all things that are with more spirit chased than enjoyed. Johnson, The Rambler, number 71, 1750. The pleasure of expecting enjoyment is often greater than that of obtaining it, and the completion of almost every wish is found a disappointment. 4. Disgust with possession. A related but distinct Stoic law of desire. Having a thing tends to bring about indifference or contempt towards it. Sometimes this is because finally possessing what one wanted allows its unimportance to be exposed. Seneca, Epistles, 118, 6-7. You regard the objects you seek as lofty because you lie far away from them. To him who has reached them, they are small and mean. And I am very much mistaken if he does not desire to climb still higher. That which you regard as the top is merely a rung on the ladder. Now everyone suffers from ignorance of the truth. Deceived by what they hear others say, they seek these ends as if they were good, and then, after having won their wish and suffered much, they find them evil or empty or less important than they had expected. Compare Schopenhauer, On the Vanity of Existence, 1851. To obtain something we have desired is to find out that it is worthless. We are always living in expectation of better things, while at the same time we often repent and long for things that belong to the past. But the Stoics regard the difficulty as deeper still. Anything loses its power to satisfy once it is possessed, not just because we see it more realistically, but because possession itself changes how we feel about it. No acquisition or stimulation makes the same impression on us with long exposure. Seneca, Natural Questions 4b 13:11. Do you not realize that all things lose their force because of familiarity? Seneca, Epistles 81:28. We value nothing more highly than a benefit when we are seeking it, but nothing less highly once we obtain it. Seneca, Epistles 115:17. Would that those who crave wealth could compare notes with those who have it. Would that those who seek political office could confer with the ambitious who have gained the highest honors. They would then surely change their desires, seeing that these grandees are always gaping after new gains and despising what they formerly sought. For there is no one in the world who is contented with his prosperity, even if it is continuous. People complain about their plans and about getting what they planned. They always prefer what they have failed to win. An example of the pattern on a social rather than individual level from a visit Seneca made to the villa of Scipio Africanus. Seneca, Epistles 86:8. In Scipio's bathhouse, there are tiny chinks, you cannot call them windows, cut out of the stone wall, in such a way as to admit light without weakening the fortifications. Nowadays, however, people regard baths as fit for moths, unless they have been so arranged that they receive the sun all day long through the widest openings, unless you can bathe and get a tan at the same time, unless there is a view from the tub over land and sea. So it goes. The establishments that had drawn crowds and admiration when they were first opened are avoided and accounted old-fashioned as soon as luxury has worked out some new way to outdo itself. Montaigne was a close observer of the corrosive effect that familiarity and surfeit have on our affections. Montaigne, Of Presumption, 1580. I am bothered by a defect in my soul that I dislike both for its injustice and, even more, for the trouble it causes. I try to correct it, but cannot get it out by the roots. It is that I value too lightly the things that I have, just because I have them, and overvalue things that are foreign, things that are absent, and things that don't belong to me. Possession breeds contempt for whatever we hold and control. Montaigne, Of the Inequality Amongst Us, 1580. Nothing is as distasteful and clogging as abundance. What appetite would not be repelled by seeing 300 women at its mercy, as the Grand Turk has in his seraglio? And what appetite for so-called hunting did one of his ancestors maintain for himself, who never went into the fields with fewer than 7,000 falconers? Johnson also had remarks on this theme. Johnson, The Rambler, number 78, 1750. Corporal sensation is known to depend so much upon novelty that custom takes away from many things their power of giving pleasure or pain. Thus, a new dress becomes easy by wearing it, and the palate is reconciled by degrees to dishes which at first disgusted it. Something similar or analogous may be observed in effects produced immediately upon the mind. Nothing can strongly strike or affect us but what is rare or sudden. The most important events, when they become familiar, are no longer considered with wonder or solicitude, and that which at first filled up our whole attention and left no place for any other thought is soon thrust aside into some remote repository of the mind and lies among other lumber of the memory, overlooked and neglected. Johnson, The Rambler, number 207, 1752. Such is the emptiness of human enjoyment that we are always impatient of the present. Attainment is followed by neglect, and possession by disgust. And the malicious remark of the Greek epigrammatist on marriage may be applied to every other course of life, that its 2 days of happiness are the first and the last. Johnson was probably putting a more graceful construction onto an ugly saying of Hipponax, a Greek poet from the 6th century BC. There are 2 days when a woman is a pleasure, the day one marries her, and the day one carries out her dead body. Our topic in this section might be considered an aspect of what psychologists today sometimes call adaptation, the tendency to become used to things, and to stop noticing them, and all that follows from this. Stoics are keen students of adaptation and its workings, some of which help us, and some of which make us worse off. Adaptation was relevant to Chapter 1, for example, because getting accustomed to a condition can cause us to regard it as natural and inevitable when it isn't. Adaptation will be relevant again when we take up the subject of adversity, because adaptation helps with its management. Adaptation also is at the root of many desires, because it corrodes our ability to find pleasure in whatever we already have, and so drives us on to new wants. Smith nicely tied the phenomenon to a larger Stoic claim. Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, 1759. The never-failing certainty with which all men, sooner or later, accommodate themselves to whatever becomes their permanent situation may, perhaps, induce us to think that the Stoics were, at least, thus, far very nearly in the right, that between one permanent situation and another there was, with regard to real happiness, no essential difference, or that, if there were any difference, it was no more than just sufficient to render some of them the objects of simple choice or preference, but not of any earnest or anxious desire, and others of simple rejection, as being fit to be set aside or avoided, but not of any earnest or anxious aversion. 5. Envy. Attainment of our desires fails to satisfy, in part, because we measure our satisfaction with what we have by comparing it to what others have. It is always possible to find someone who seemed to be ahead of us, or to have more than us, and those tend to be the only comparisons we care about. Seneca, On Anger, 3:30-3. That man will never be happy whom the sight of a happier man will torment. Seneca on Anger, 3:31-1. No man, when he views the lot of others, is content with his own. This is why we grow angry even at the gods, because some person is ahead of us, forgetting how many men there are behind us, and how huge a mass of envy follows at the back of him who envies but a few. Nevertheless, such is the presumptuousness of men that, although they may have received much, they count it an injury that they might have received more. Seneca, Epistles 104:9. Suppose you regard wealth as a good. Poverty will distress you, and, worst of all, it will be an imaginary poverty. However much you may have, still, because someone has more, you will feel that you fall short to the extent he is ahead. You consider official position a good. This man, being made a consul, will vex you, or that one's being reappointed, and you will be envious whenever you see another's name appearing frequently on the list of office holders. Such is the madness of ambition that you will feel you have come in last if anyone is ahead of you. Epictetus Discourses 1:9-20. Why should one person envy another? Why be awed by the rich or the powerful, especially those who are strong and quick to anger? For what will they do to us? What they can do, we don't care about. What we care about, they cannot do. Everyone can be envious of somebody, if not of one who is achieving more, than of one who is achieving something else. Plutarch, On Tranquility of Mind, 13:473b. Not only are men jealous of fellow craftsmen, and those who share the same life as themselves, but also the wealthy envy the learned, the famous, the rich, advocates, the sophists, and by heaven, freemen and patricians regard with wondering admiration and envy successful comedians in the theater, and dancers, and servants in the courts of kings. And by so doing, they afford themselves no small vexation and disturbance. Envy doesn't just make us less satisfied. It makes us desire things that we otherwise wouldn't want at all. Seneca, Epistles 123:6. And how much do we acquire simply because our neighbors have acquired such things, or because most men possess them? Envy, like other topics in this chapter, has provoked much discussion by descendants of the Stoics. Johnson was a perceptive analyst of the problem. He spun out this last idea of Seneca's a bit. Johnson, The Adventurer, Number 3, 1753. Many of our miseries are merely comparative. We are often made unhappy not by the presence of any real evil, but by the absence of some fictitious good, of something which is not required by any real want of nature, which has not in itself any power of gratification, and which neither reason nor fancy would have prompted us to wish, did we not see it in the possession of others. He also observed, in his characteristic style, the universal character of the general problem, our imaginings of others. Johnson, The Rambler, Number 63, 1750. It has been remarked, perhaps by every writer who has left behind him observations upon life, that no man is pleased with his present state, which proves equally unsatisfactory, says Horace, whether fallen upon by chance or chosen with deliberation. We are always disgusted with some circumstance or other of our situation, and imagine the condition of others more abundant in blessings or less exposed to calamities. And Johnson noted finally that while it may or may not make us happier to have what someone else does, we are definitely made unhappy by envy of it. Johnson, The Rambler, Number 128, 1751. Such is the state of every age, every sex, and every condition. All have their cares, either from nature or from folly. And whoever therefore finds himself inclined to envy another should remember that he knows not the real condition which he desires to obtain, but is certain that by indulging a vicious passion, he must lessen that happiness which he thinks already too sparingly bestowed. Schopenhauer added that envy is the rare vice that makes us unhappy on the spot. Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. Envy is at once a vice and a source of misery. We should treat it as the enemy of our happiness, and stifle it like an evil thought. This is the advice given by Seneca, as he well puts it. We shall be pleased with what we have if we avoid the self-torture of comparing our own lot with some other and happier one. Envy can be considered an instance of a larger problem, useless comparisons, on which Smith again had a good comment. Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, 1759. The great source of both the misery and disorders of human life seems to arise from overrating the difference between one permanent situation and another. Avarice overrates the difference between poverty and riches. Ambition, that between a private and a public station. Vainglory, that between obscurity and extensive reputation. The person under the influence of any of those extravagant passions is not only miserable in his actual situation, but is often disposed to disturb the peace of society, in order to arrive at that which he so foolishly admires. The slightest observation, however, might satisfy him that, in all the ordinary situations of human life, a well-disposed mind may be equally calm, equally cheerful, and equally contented. 6. Desires and Opinions. We turn from the Stoic diagnosis of desire to the remedies, the most direct antidotes. Here, and in most cases, are those introduced in the first two chapters of this book. One can work to view the object of a desire accurately, and thus seek detachment from it. Attachments to externals are, in general, breeding grounds for envy and other vices. Or one can perceive a desire as just another misjudgment, and, if the talent for doing so has been developed, simply dismiss it. To restate the point, the principle of Chapter 1 treats the mind and its opinions as responsible for what we want. It follows that any desire can be satisfied, or addressed anyway, in two ways. One can go after the object of the desire, or one can get to work on the other half of the problem, the opinion that produces it. Solving the equation in this way, from the right-hand side rather than the left, as we might think of it, is standard Stoic procedure. Epictetus, Discourses, 4.1.175. Freedom is attained not by satisfying desires, but by removing them. Seneca, Epistles, 1.23.3. No one can have whatever he wants. What he can do is not want what he doesn't have, and cheerfully enjoy what comes his way. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 9.40. One man prays, "Help me go to bed with that woman." You pray, "Help me not to lust after going to bed with her." Another, "Help me be released from that." You, "Help me not need to be released." Another, "How shall I not lose my little son?" You, "How shall I not be afraid to lose him?" Turn your prayers this way and see what happens. Musonius Rufus, That One Should Disdain Hardships. Wouldn't anyone admit how much better it is, instead of working hard to get possession of someone else's wife, to work hard to restrain your desires? Instead of being distressed about money, to train yourself to want little? Instead of working to become famous, to work not to thirst for fame? Instead of finding a way to hurt someone you envy, to find a way not to envy anyone? And instead of acting as a slave to false friends, as sycophants do, to suffer hardships in order to find true friends? Epicurus offered a statement at this point of which Seneca approved. Epicurus quoted in Seneca, Epistles 21:7. If you wish to make Pythocles rich, do not add to his store of money, but subtract from his desires. Seneca liked it well enough that he thought the logic could be multiplied. Seneca, Epistles 21:8. If you want to make Pythocles distinguished, don't add to his distinctions, but diminish his desires. If you want Pythocles to have endless enjoyment, don't add to his enjoyments, but diminish his desires. If you want to make Pythocles an old man, living his life to the full, don't add to his years, but diminish his desires. 7. Useful Comparisons to Other People. Dealing with desires by dropping them, as just shown, is the first line of Stoic response, and perhaps all that is needed on a purist's view. but the late Stoics knew that such a direct approach can be very difficult, so they offered other psychological strategies for the management of desire as well. The Stoics criticized comparisons that cause discontent, as we have seen, but they recommend comparisons that have the opposite effect. One might suppose that all comparisons to others ought to be held strictly irrelevant, that to reduce unhappiness by looking at others who are unhappier makes no more sense than reducing happiness by looking at others who are happier still. But this is another instance of pragmatism in the late Stoics, especially Seneca. They judge a perspective by its consequences. A comparison may be recommended just because it helps free us from tendencies of the mind that have already been diagnosed as unwanted. Some of the healthy comparisons suggested by the Stoics are to people and circumstances from the past. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind, 12:4. Whenever I look back at the examples of antiquity, I am ashamed to seek any consolations for poverty. The extravagance of our day have reached the point that the travel expenses of exiles are more than the inheritances of princes in former times. Comparisons to others who have been in the same boat can likewise be productive. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind, 6, 467e. It will also help greatly toward tranquility of mind to observe that famous men have suffered nothing at all from evils the same as yours. Does childlessness, for example, vex you? Consider the kings of Rome, of whom not one was able to bequeath the kingdom to a son. Are you distressed by your present poverty? Well, what Boeotian, rather than Epaminondas, what Roman, rather than Fabricius, would you have preferred to be? Epaminondas was a revered Greek statesman and general in the 4th century BC, who was well known for his simple manner of living. Fabricius was a consul in early Rome. He, too, had a reputation for austerity. Useful comparisons can also be drawn to those in the present who are worse off than oneself. Our tendency is always to look in the other direction, up rather than down. Seneca, Epistles 73:3. No man in public life thinks of the many whom he has surpassed. He thinks rather of those by whom he is surpassed. And these men find it less pleasing to see many behind them than annoying to see anyone ahead of them. That is the trouble with every sort of ambition. It does not look back. The Stoics recommend changing the direction in which we look for comparisons to decide how we are doing. Envy may in effect be reversed. Seneca on Anger, 3:31-3. Are there many who surpass you? Consider how many more are behind than ahead of you. Do you ask me what is your greatest fault? Your bookkeeping is wrong. What you have paid out, you value highly. What you have received, low. Plutarch made this point well, too. It is up to us to choose the people to whom we compare ourselves. This allows us to rig the contest. Whether or not this is good philosophy, it is helpful psychology. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind, 10, 470e. In the Olympic Games, you can't win by choosing your competitors. But in life, circumstances allow you to take pride in your superiority to many, and to be envied rather than envious of others. Unless, of course, you make Briareus or Hercules your opponent. When you are marveling at the greatness of Xerxes crossing the Hellespont, as a local once did, look also at those who are digging through Mount Athos beneath the lash, and those whose ears and noses are mutilated because the bridge was broken by the current. Consider that, at the same time, they are thinking how happy your life and your fortunes are. Xerxes I of Persia had sought to invade Greece in 480 BC. His path required his army to dig a canal near Mount Athos in Greece and to build a 4,000-foot pontoon bridge over the Hellespont, now the Dardanelles, the strait separating Asia from Europe. The first version of the bridge collapsed, after which Xerxes ordered terrible retributions against those he held responsible, along with a vengeful flogging of the nearby waters by his soldiers. Upon seeing Xerxes make his crossing at last, a local is said to have compared him to Zeus, as recounted in Herodotus, Histories 7:56. As for Briareus, he was a creature from Greek mythology, with 50 heads and 100 arms. An example that needs less explanation. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind, 2, 471b. When that renowned Pittacus, whose fame for bravery and for wisdom and justice was great, was entertaining some guests, his wife entered in a rage and upset the table. His guests were dismayed, but Pittacus said, "Every one of us has some trouble. He that has only mine is doing very well indeed." Pittacus was one of the seven sages of Greece, the circle of statesmen and philosophers from the 6th century BC who were celebrated for the wisdom in classical times. Some more recent continuations of these ideas. Montaigne on Vanity, 1580. "In all circumstances we compare ourselves to what is above us, and look to those who are better off. Let us measure ourselves instead by what is below. None are so miserable that they cannot find 1,000 examples to provide consolation." Boswell, Life of Johnson, 1791. "I mentioned the advice given us by philosophers to console ourselves, when distressed or embarrassed, by thinking of those who are in a worse situation than ourselves. This, I observed, could not apply to all, for there must be some who have nobody worse than they are." Johnson, "Why, to be sure, sir, there are, but they don't know it. There is no being so poor and so contemptible who does not think there is somebody still poorer and still more contemptible." Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. "It is a fact that if real calamity comes upon us, the most effective consolation, though it springs from the same source as envy, is just the thought of greater misfortunes than ours. And the next best is the society of those who are in the same luck as we, the partners of our sorrows." A variant, Johnson, Letter to Hester Thrale, 1770. "When any calamity has been suffered, the first thing to be remembered is how much has been escaped." Our current teaching might be further illustrated by imagining a marketplace for miseries and asking whether we would want to make trades there. If this notion does not seem directly related to the problem of desire, consider it another device for increasing contentment with what one has. Plutarch, Letter to Apollonius, 9, 106b. "If we were all to bring our misfortunes into a common store, so that each person should receive an equal share in the distribution, the majority would be glad to take up their own and depart." Herodotus offered a similar idea. Herodotus, Histories, 7, 152. "This, however, I know full well, that if all men were to carry their own private troubles to market for barter with their neighbors, there would not be a single one who, when he had looked into the troubles of other men, would not be glad to carry home again what he had brought." 8. Useful comparisons to loss. Another valuable comparison considers how desirable the goods we have would seem if they were absent. We saw earlier the role that adaptation plays in creating desires that never end. Getting used to what we have causes us to lose appreciation for it. The Stoics respond by trying to see old things freshly. Instead of changing their possessions, they try to change the way they view them. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 7:27. "Don't imagine having things that you don't have. Rather, pick the best of the things that you do have and think of how much you would want them if you didn't have them." Epicurus, Vatican Sayings, 35. "Don't spoil what's here by longing for what's not here, but realize that these two are things to be prayed for." Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. "We should sometimes try to look upon our possessions in the light in which they would appear if we had lost them." Compare Epictetus, Discourses, 3:9-21. "To you everything you have appears small. All my things appear great to me." The same idea can be applied to conditions rather than to things. It is a way to build gratitude not just for what one has, but for one's circumstances and situation. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind, 9, 469 E to F. "We should not overlook even common and ordinary things, but take some account of them, and be grateful that we are alive and well, and look upon the sun. These things, when they are present, will afford us greater tranquility of mind. If we but imagine them to be absent, and remind ourselves often how desirable is health to the sick, and peace to those at war, and to an unknown stranger in so great a city, the acquisition of reputation and friends, and how painful it is to be deprived of these things when we have once had them. For it will not then be the case that we find each one of these important and valuable, only when it has been lost, but worthless while securely held. Chapter 6. Wealth and Pleasure. Chapter 5 considered some general properties of desires, their never-ending character, and the ways they are fed by comparisons, how they deceive us, and how they might be tamed. This chapter considers more specific Stoic teachings on two temptations in particular, wealth and pleasure. Every such temptation is accompanied by its own origins, snares, and illusions, and also by questions about whether or how it can be enjoyed in a way that is consistent with peace of mind and other Stoic aspirations. A few ideas from the previous chapter will be revisited here and applied to more particular problems. On a Stoic view, money and our fascination with it, greed, tends to make us ridiculous and to cause much misery to ourselves and to others. The Stoics hold that attachment to wealth has predictable consequences. Once we have money, we worry about keeping it, are anxious for more of it, and feel pain when it is lost. We feel a desire for more of whatever we have, and gradually value all sorts of things more highly than they are worth. These points can be applied to pleasure more generally. We overrate pleasures and underrate the cost of trying to gain them. Pleasure and pain are parts of a cycle. They go together and have to be addressed together. After considering those ideas, this chapter will turn from warnings about wealth and pleasure to ideas about the use and management of them. Stoicism suggests first that we rethink what we want, how much of it, and why. Stoics value moderation, and they don't view it as a compromise of pleasures. They regard moderation, rather, as enhancing pleasures, indeed as making the true and healthy enjoyment of them possible. A second Stoic resource is detachment. One can learn to enjoy wealth and pleasures without grasping for them, holding them too tightly when one has them, or being crushed when they are gone. Third, to continue a theme from the previous chapter, the easiest way to real wealth is by learning to be happy with less, with enough. There is no difference, so far as contentment is concerned, between having something and not caring whether you have it. The second route often is easier. The last sections of the chapter consider the pleasures that Stoics do embrace, the kind they regard as natural, and that we experience when we satisfy the appetites we are born with. Seneca considers recreation and games to be among these, and he recognizes a place for drinking as well. Above all, though, the Stoic is attracted to the pleasures of the mind. Stoics regard wisdom and understanding as producing a kind of joy that is immune from interruption by circumstance. 1. Hazards of Money. The Stoics generally consider money to be a great corrupter of the individual and of social life. Money is hard to see and understand clearly. It causes us to misjudge the value of things, and it drives those who worship it into low behavior. Seneca, Epistles 115:10. That very thing which occupies so many magistrates and so many judges, which makes both magistrates and judges, money, since it began to be regarded with honor, has caused true honor to fall into ruin, becoming alternately merchants and merchandise by turns. We ask not what a thing truly is, but what it costs. Seneca on Anger, 3:33-1. Most of the outcry is about money. It is this that wearies the courts, pits father against son, brews poisons, and gives swords to the legions and to cutthroats alike. Because of it, nights resound with the quarrels of husbands and wives, crowds swarm to the tribunals of the magistrates, kings rage and plunder and overthrow states that have been built by the long labor of centuries in order that they may search for gold and silver in the very ashes of cities. Seneca rejected the claim that riches are no more harmful in themselves than swords. Seneca, Epistles 87:31. Posidonius holds that riches are a cause of evil, not because they do evil themselves, but because of the evil they goad men to do. Riches puff up the spirit and beget pride. They bring on envy and unsettle the mind to such an extent that a reputation for having money delights us, even when that reputation will do us harm. Posidonius was a Stoic philosopher of the middle period in the ancient life of the school, 2nd century BC. Dr. Johnson emphasized the worthlessness of money on its own. Johnson, The Rambler, number 58, 1750. Wealth is nothing in itself. It is not useful, but when it departs from us. Its value is found only in that which it can purchase, which, if we suppose it put to its best use by those that possess it, seems not much to deserve the desire or envy of a wise man. 2. The effect of wealth on its holder. The previous chapter discussed ways in which acquisitions fail to satisfy the appetite for them. The same can be said for money, which Stoics view as having no particular tendency to make people happier. Seneca, Consolation to Helvia, 12:1. Consider how many more people are poor than rich. And yet you will observe that the poor are no unhappier and no more anxious than the rich. Seneca, Epistle 17:11-12. I will borrow from Epicurus. The acquisition of riches has been for many men not an end of troubles, but a change of them. I do not wonder, for the fault is not in one's wealth, but in the mind itself. That which had made poverty a burden to us has made riches a burden as well. It matters little whether you lay a sick man on a bed of wood or a bed of gold. Wherever he be moved, he will carry his disease with him. So, too, it matters not whether a diseased mind is set down in wealth or in poverty. The malady follows the man. Plutarch, On Love of Wealth 1, 523d. When some persons praised a tall fellow with a long reach as having the makings of a fine boxer, the trainer Hippomachus remarked, "Yes, if the crown were hung up and to be got by reaching, so too we can say to those who are dazzled by fine estates, great houses, and large sums of money, and regard them as the greatest of blessings. Yes, if happiness were for sale, and to be got by purchase." Hippomachus was a trainer of boxers and wrestlers. He evidently had a talent for philosophy as well. He will appear again in Chapter 7, Section 3. The Stoic suspicion of money goes further than just shown. They hold not only that wealth fails to satisfy, but that it tends to rule those who possess it, and bring about its own forms of unhappiness. Seneca, Epistles 14:18. He who has need of riches feels fear on their account, but no man enjoys a blessing that brings anxiety. He is always trying to add a little more. While he puzzles over increasing his wealth, he forgets how to use it. Seneca, Epistles 1:15-16. What tears and toil does avarice exact! How wretched it is in desiring! How wretched in what it has acquired! Add to this the daily worries that torment us in proportion to our possessions. To have money brings more anxiety than the effort to acquire it. How we grieve over our losses, which may be great, and which seem even greater. And then, even if fortune takes nothing away from us, we regard as a further loss whatever we cannot get. Seneca regarded the eventual consequence of greed to be a certain type of diseased judgment. Seneca, Epistles 75:11. We might define the disease this way: to strive too hard for things that are only worth wanting a little or not at all, or to value things highly that ought to be valued only somewhat or not at all. 3. Hazards of pleasure. The Stoic attitude toward wealth can be generalized to pleasure. Stoics view pleasures as costlier than they seem, as not lasting long, as always exacting a price, and as invariably alternating with some sort of loss or pain. Seneca, Epistles 59:15. One person seeks joy in feasting and self-indulgence, another in elections and crowds of supporters, another in his mistress, another in the idle display of culture and in literature that has no power to heal. All of them are led astray by delights that are deceptive and short-lived, like drunkenness, for example, which pays for a single hour of hilarious madness with a long-lasting sickness, or like applause and enthusiastic popularity and approval that are gained and atoned for at the cost of great mental disquietude. Seneca, On the Happy Life, 4:4. The day a man becomes subject to pleasure, he will also be subject to pain. And you see what wretched and hateful slavery a person is in when pleasures and pains, those most capricious and tyrannical masters, take captive of him in turn. Montaigne of Solitude, 1580. The sages teach us well to beware the treachery of our appetites, and to distinguish true and complete pleasures from those that are mixed and interwoven with even more pain. Most pleasures, they say, caress and embrace us, only to strangle us, like the thieves the Egyptians called Philistia. If we felt the headache before getting drunk, we would be careful not to drink to excess. But pleasure, to deceive us, walks in front and hides its train. Montaigne, That We Taste Nothing Pure, 1580. Ease crushes us. That is the sense of an ancient Greek verse, which says the gods sell us every good they give us. That is to say, they give us nothing pure and perfect, nothing that we do not buy at the cost of some evil. The Greek verse Montaigne mentions is from Epicharmus, a Greek poet, circa 540 to circa 450 BC. He was reputed in classical times to be a great master of drama and comedy, but very little has survived from him. The line at issue here was preserved in Xenophon's Memorabilia of Socrates, 2:1:20. Marcus Aurelius